It's Darren Winston's book report.
Hey, Jill.
Hey, Darren. What have you found out there?
What have I found?
You know, you've got an exchange going on. Books definitely go out. You told us in an earlier show that you sent out, I don't know, 40 books or something.
Right.
So obviously, that leaves 40 spaces.
Right.
It's you. Something must be coming in.
Yep. No, you're right. Books come in and books go out. And sadly, that 40-plus order is definitely an anomaly. I've had a couple of interesting house calls recently, and one of which, and this happens often, and I think I've talked about it, where I'll go into a house and the books will be, let's say there's 500 books, 400 of them will be from like an 8-year period, and then the rest of them are this combination of much, much earlier, perhaps when the owners were children or they inherited these books, and then there'll be some that are much, much newer, either very recent, you know, in the last year or in the last 10 or 15 years. And I see those patterns enough to know that, you know, A, people's habits are consistent in a way, meaning from person to person. But also it shows, okay, you bought all these books and then you got married perhaps, or you had children, or you moved and you moved from a big house to a little house. And there's points at which things are clearly purged, but things are clearly kept behind. And the house I was in was largely frozen in time from about 1950 to 1965 or 70. There was, again, things that predated that and postdated it, but almost all of it was that time. And I found lots of fun stuff, kind of some literature, some natural history, you know, the sort of things that I like to find. They're different, and they are perhaps nice copies of a different thing, because there's always that criteria. It can't just be another copy of Jane Eyre. It has to be a copy of Jane Eyre that is interesting in some respect, either because of the illustrations or the binding or the overall design or whatever the case may be.
Which then means you need to... Don't try this at home, but you need to have some sense of the different versions of Jane Eyre that's out
right.
there.
And in this case, instead of, not to digress, but that's not book learned as much as just every time I go through a bunch of books, I take these snapshots like we talked about, where you kind of have to have a photographic memory to some extent so that you can remember that you saw something or you handled something. One of the books that I found, there was a group of books, let's say there was 1,000 books in this house, and I took a few away that purported to be more important than they should have been. And I talked to the owner and I said, look, let me find out more about these before we do anything, before I buy them, before I advise you, before whatever. And one of the books was a Mark Twain first. And in the world of Mark Twain, there's Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer, and then there's everything else. The differences are huge in terms of value. The other books still can be worth thousands, but not multiples of thousands like the Huck Finn and Tom Sawyer can. I think this one was, I think it was Following the Equator. I could be wrong. And it appeared to be a first edition. I went and consulted a few bibliographies and was reminded that one of the points to determine how early the book was printed was a mistake, a printing mistake. And we've talked about that before. And it's literally called a point. So it said, you know, go to page such and such and look for this character. So I did. And what I found was that someone in the last 100 years had tried to scratch the letter off the page, thereby making it appear as though it were the one with the missing letter. And I went back to the owner and I said, I can't help you with it, or I can't recommend anything, because what you have is sort of an imposter. And I said, I'm not implicating you or even your family, but at some point someone knew this and they tried to undo it. And if I tried to sell it for you, I would have to sell it with that knowledge, and I would unravel almost any potential sale, because I would say, here's this thing, it's, you know, it's trying to be a first edition, it's not, and here's why. It's a great story, but who's going to want to give you money for that story? So that went back into the mix, and I said, you know, if you can afford to keep it, just keep it. Still a great book, it's still a classic, it's all of these things, and now it has this funny story that you didn't realize, because who would have known, and I'm sure your parents didn't know. And Mark Twain is one of those authors who was sort of collected almost simultaneously. He wasn't discovered or rediscovered or anything like that. His books, like Dickens, were kind of, you know, really from the get-go collected. And out of that same house, I found a book that there were clergy in the history of the family. And I found a very old religious book. I can't remember if it was, it wasn't a Bible, so it was some sort of prayer book. And it was in its original binding, its 18th century binding, very early 18th century binding, but it had a pretty modern repair, which is called a reback, where the spine essentially was replaced. And without going into too much detail, you can replace the spine, particularly on something like a religious book where you're opening it constantly, just to make the book work again. You take away the broken bits and you replace it. This was done very well without much love for the rest of the binding, which is a shame. Whoever did it did a good job, but it doesn't look, you know, you could also do that sort of thing in a period style or, you know, making it invisible. That aside, my first thought was this was important enough to have it repaired. This is a, you know, almost 300-year-old book. Why was it done that way? And in the front of the book were two names, a name above a place name and a separate name. And I was able to determine that the first name with the place name was this kind of famous 18th century clergyman. And the second name was, if I remember correctly, a woman that lived in the vicarage after when he was an elderly man, and the book must have passed to her. And there was a much later note, and I say later, it was still 100 years old, but it was in pencil, saying something like, my father was given this book from so-and-so, and here I give it to you. So I had what must have been the line of provenance from the original owner to a known sort of second owner. Some time passed, and then, so maybe 100 years where I can't account for it, although it could have been in the second owner's hands, appears in the owner who's inscribed to, and it's still in that family. And the point I'm trying to make is the book looked completely innocuous. It was an old religious book. They don't tend to have value for content because they were produced, you know, voluminously. But by looking backward at these names, I suddenly had this trail. And then I looked on the cover of the book, and there were two initials. And you don't find old bindings with people's names or initials on them very often. When you do, tends to be for a specific reason, but you do see it a lot with religious books, probably because you go to church with 50 other people and there's 50 other copies of the same or similar book. And I think the initials were IF, and I thought, okay, IF, so 1703 or whatever the time was, that could be JF, because back then I was not a common, I was used for J, because J wasn't a common letter. And the guy's initials were JF. So I thought, okay, so it was important enough he had his initials. Maybe it was his working, you know, a copy of this particular book. And all of a sudden, this story goes sort of backwards. The whole history of the thing just keeps getting bigger and more interesting. And the more I look into who he was and his importance unto himself and why perhaps the second owner kept the book, and then that sort of notoriety continued, and here it is where it's now a little wisp of a thing, but it's got a great story if you're interested in the story. But it can all be, all the pieces are there. There was no jiggery pokery. It was just, this is what we know about it, and this is how we got there.
And that's important in the story and history. And I was just thinking while you were telling that story, wow, so how do you, are we going to get to a point, since so many people are enkindled, you know, so many people are digital, we're going to get to a point where it just suddenly, you know, falls off, just speaking of precipice, just cuts off? Because how do you keep track of, let's say that there's a wonderful book that's written now, be digital, there'll be a few, you know, four or five hard copies of it because no one wants that anymore. And what do you do in 150 years?
You know, it's funny, there's a much longer discussion than we have time for, but I think a quick answer is you almost weirdly revert to an oral tradition, because if no one has a hard copy of the book and it's only read digitally, then it can only be through word of mouth that it stays alive. Just like before printing, So, well, actually, before printing, things were kept alive orally as well as writing them down in manuscript. But in lots of, you know, native cultures, it's all just telling the story. So maybe in 150 years, it'll be the great David Foster Wallace and something that he published. Now, he's a bad example because his stuff does exist in print. But perhaps in some weird way, we'll go back to that tradition.
To the oral tradition, which means that people, there will be storytellers of the generation, and somebody at some point will write the Bible.
It sounds like an updated Planet of the Apes, to be honest, with the Statue of Liberty appearing in the sand like that.
But not trying to do that.
It might just happen.
Really trying to think it through. Last night, mildly to the point, I picked up an old book that was an old Wodehouse book. All right, so funny, so well written. I didn't even remember what the story. It was a throwaway story, not one of his most famous ones. But as I'm watching the language come to life on the page, thinking, you know, this is really enjoyable. I didn't have that much time to read, and it was just, you know, a few minutes before I fell asleep. But just that it's living, and I don't know how you keep it alive on flat. I don't know how you keep it alive on flat.
I think that's one of the beautiful things about writing in general, but with books, with our accessibility to them, because this is not the 15th century, you have the possibility of that experience all the time. And sometimes people will ask me, and I remember somebody saying very seriously, why does anybody keep books? You know, you read it, then you're done. You know, you get rid of it, you pass it along. And without, again, getting into a long discussion, one of my answers would be, well, when I walk past my bookshelves at home in particular, I basically see the story of my life in books, things I read as a very small child, as a not so small child, as a young teen, as a young adult, all of these different things. There's these little sort of signposts, and I know that we've talked about my sort of epiphany when it came to book selling was finding a copy of The Grapes of Wrath and having the exact same experience you talked about, reading a book I knew nothing about and those characters climbing out of the book almost in some sort of Twilight Zone way, like they had been alive and just waiting for me to find them. And but of course that's the genius of John Steinbeck, and that's the genius of the craft, and it's maybe one of the reasons we read, that you can these things are just forever waiting just to be discovered, even if it's just you rediscovering it in your own home over and over again. But when people come into my shop, it's like going into a cocktail party and everyone is potentially interesting and you just have to get a chance to take one off the shelf and have a look.
It's Darren Winston's Book Report.
Thanks, Jill.